Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Kian. Today we'll discuss the article by Walker et al. Titled Biochemical and Myofilament Responses of the Right Ventricle to Severe Pulmonary Hypertension. This article published online ahead of print May 27, 2011. My guests today are Associate Editor Meredith Bond, authors Lori Walker and Peter Buttrick, and leading expert J.P. Jin. Let's get started.
This is a particularly interesting study focusing for a change on the right ventricle and right ventricular cardiac disease and some of the biochemical changes that occur during development of right ventricular failure and pulmonary hypertension. This is an area where few people have actually investigated what might be the basis of altered contractility of the right ventricle. So my first question would be for Peter Buttrick to tell us, why is it important that we focus for change on some of the changes in right ventricular function?
Meredith, thanks for the question. We were very interested in the right ventricle for a number of reasons. One, of course, it's understudied. And two, the right ventricle really from a clinical standpoint is exceptionally important, and right ventricular function, even more than left ventricular function, defines clinical outcomes. The right ventricle, of course, is structurally quite distinct from the left ventricle, and therapies that have been used clinically to treat left ventricular failure when applied to the context of right ventricular disease actually don't work.
So to follow up on that, the critical importance of the health of the right ventricle, if you want to put it that way, and the sort of dearth of information, why do you think that is? Why have people not paid attention to the right ventricle? Is it in fact that the appropriate animal model was not available?
No, I think that's obviously part of it. And we were really struck by the particular animal model that was studied in this manuscript. Also, frankly, clinically, the right ventricle is very hard to image. So getting an accurate snapshot of right ventricular function is challenging. The left ventricle is obviously more prominent. It's concentric, easy to capture with a spectrum of non-invasive imaging tools. And the right ventricle is crescentic-shaped, very difficult to get an accurate snapshot of function. So I think there's been a number of things that have conspired to make studying of this particular chamber difficult. As you mentioned, we really were delighted with access to this particular animal model, which is a large animal model of isolated right ventricular dysfunction. And of course, as everybody who works with mice knows, the availability of grams of tissue as opposed to milligrams of tissue to study is extremely appealing.
So maybe I'll turn now to our expert, JP. Give us your insights into the significance of this study and the importance of the question.
Sure. As the interesting part is the myofilament protein gene expression stayed rather stable. And there seems more sensitive adaptation in the post-translational changes of key contractile proteins, which is an intriguing finding. This is a very few large animal model which have slower heart rate, have a similar physiological feature as the human hearts to be studied, although there's limitations.
Lori, can you tell us a little bit about how you went about this study and in particular the novelty of working with the calf heart?
Absolutely, and thank you, Meredith. The experimental animals are taken to approximately 14,000 feet of simulated atmosphere, so it's very low pressure. They're held in a hyperbaric chamber in Fort Collins, which is a little bit of a drive from Denver, so it's quite a team effort. One of the interesting findings in this paper is that we were not studying the effect of hypoxia on the ventricle, even though that's how they developed right heart failure, that they were exposed to hyperbaric hypoxia. We looked at the left ventricle, and functionally the left ventricle did not demonstrate the same deficits in function. So it wasn't in response to the hypoxia, but rather the pressure overload. But the functional deficit was not apparent in the left ventricle.
Maybe tell us, Laurie, is this an unexpected finding that there was a differential effect between on the left and right ventricle? And
it wasn't unexpected. We hypothesized that there would be a unique right ventricular response because of the significant pressure overload that the right ventricle experiences. However, we did think that there may be some deficit in the left ventricle due to the hypoxia, but we did not find that. So the pressure overload in the right ventricle seems to be driving the molecular changes that we see in the RV.
I'm sure you have a follow-up study to analyze the left ventricular muscle molecular changes. Those will be an excellent control to see what is the direct effect of hypoxia, what is the secondary effect of the pressure overload.
I agree, and we are indeed following up on this study, looking at the left ventricle. We're also looking at some of the hypoxia-responsive proteins, the HIFs and such, to see if there are molecular changes in expression or localization of those.
So perhaps we can now move on. Some of the specific changes were some changes in phosphorylation, but was not necessarily done in response to what we normally do to activate phosphorylation changes with the beta-adrenergic stimulation.
Just to put it in perspective, what we found mechanically was a significant decrease in calcium sensitivity. That's usually associated with an increase in phosphorylation of proteins such as troponin I. And our findings were that there was kind of a global decrease in phosphorylation of the myofilament proteins. As in troponin I, the dephosphorylation seemed to be at the canonical pKa site, so perhaps a decrease in beta-adrenergic signaling.
Do you have any speculation or other data that would shed light on whether beta-adrenergic signaling has downstream changes?
Yes, we have not looked at, say, beta-adrenergic receptors in the right ventricle yet. We're planning on doing that.
You know, and of course, beta receptor downregulation is a characteristic feature of pressure overload in the left ventricle. So in that sense, our data were consistent with left ventricular findings. What was somewhat discordant were the mechanical changes. In general, in left ventricular failure associated with downregulation of the beta signaling pathway, one sees an increase in calcium sensitivity of the myofilament, and of course we saw a decrease in calcium sensitivity. How to marry those two pieces of data is of course challenging, and it does speak to the fact that we're looking at a complex animal model where a number of signaling pathways are integrated.
One of the astounding findings in this paper is that we don't see consistent changes in the post-translational modifications, and there appears to be a dissociation between phosphorylation and force in our model, which is unique from what's in the literature. However, there are other cases in the literature where you see the same dissociation between troponin phosphorylation and force, and it's dependent on the thick filament myosin and actin backbone. So it's seen in hypertrophic cardiomyopathies where there are certain mutations. And so I think the backbone of the myofilament being neonatal may be influencing our function significantly.
It's very important, like looking, maybe expand your myofilament protein analysis for some cytoskeleton protein or sarcomere skeleton protein like titin. Those isoform changes would give you some more lead about the background.
Absolutely. And we're following up on that now.
So I would like to thank all the participants on the podcast, Laurie Walker, Peter Buttrick, and our invited expert, JP Jin.
And to our readers, thanks for listening to the AJP Heart and Circ podcast series.